in the solid form, assuming it's not brackish, assuming it contains water that you can use without doing a whole lot of processing, you'd be amazed the amount of energy you've got to put into that water. Let me give you a quick example of that. Walking across Antarctica on Earth, and you've run out of fuel by which you cook your food and melt the snow in order to make drinkable water. You're getting thirsty. So you scoop down and pick up some of the snow or some of the ice, which is sitting at minus 40 degrees centigrade. And now in order for that ice to do you any good, as you put that into your mouth, you've got to warm up that ice from minus 40 to 0 degrees centigrade. You're putting 40 calories of heat to every one of those ice cubes just for 1 gram, 1 small gram, 1 cubic centimeter of ice. You're putting 40 calories of heat into it to bring it up to 0 degrees. Then you're putting another 80 calories into it in order to convert from the solid form to the liquid form. That's heat of fusion. Then you're putting another 37 calories into it to bring it from 0 degrees centigrade to 37 degrees centigrade, body temperature. Until you go through all of those three steps to bring it up to body temperature liquid water, your body can't use it. So you've made an investment of, 40, 80, 120, another 37, 157. 157 calories of heat goes into each gram of ice that you can pick up before you can use it. And now when that water goes into your body, let me drop it. And you're going to use that water mixed together with the food in order to metabolize, in order to create some energy and heat. You've made a 157 calorie investment just to convert it into a liquid form that you can use, and now you're going to metabolize it. Are you going to get 157 calories back out of that metabolism? The answer might be no. Might be running negative when you pick up that chunk of ice because you're thirsty and put it into your mouth. You may be losing energy faster than you're gaining. You see what I'm worried about here, Paul? W-S-2-N, K-2-I-W.
Okay, very good.
Go ahead.
Okay,
they got the same problem with the space station. And they're getting better at it. That's why they have the saboteur unit, and they take big water, they have electrolysis, and they get the so if you have enough power, I guess you could separate some of the water that before you run out of water, separate that water, and now you got hydrogen and oxygen. So you have the, I guess if you have this on Antarctica, you could do it. And then with that, you're going to take the hydrogen and maybe some methane that you have with you, or some hydrogen mixed together. There's a chemical process. It's called the saboteur process. But it eventually would work its way, try to remember the process. And there's a whole cycle involved where the only thing that's left over is methane. You can burn the methane. I remember what they're doing on the space station. They got it in the Tranquility module. I'll have to look it up again. The saboteur process. Invented, I don't know, back in the early 1900s by saboteur.
Yeah, just before you picked up, I think it was Roger that's got some further information about my calorie counting for taking frozen water. Was that you, Roger? Whoever it was? K2RIW?
Vic, it was Harry, KC2FYJ, with information on the author.
Go right ahead, Harry.
Want me to go with it?
Yeah, I spoke too soon before the machine set us up. Go right ahead, Harry. Tell us about the author.
Okay, it says here, his name is Andy Weir. He's the son of a particle physicist, has a background in computer science. He began writing the book in 2009, researching related material so that it would be as realistic as possible and based on existing technology. He studied orbital mechanics, astronomy, and the history of manned spaceflight. He said he knows the exact date of each day in the book that I got from a Wikipedia article. Back to you.
Yeah, there's an amazing amount of information you get out of Wikipedia. and it's got an amazing high hit rate from my point of view, success rate. I suspect 99% of everything you read on Wikipedia is accurate. Everybody thinks that you can't trust it. Lots of people say that. But it's peer-reviewed material. So many zillions of people are looking at it every day. If there's errors, it gets corrected real fast. So maybe I'm naive, but I trust Wikipedia. So he's made a significant investment. He's written a good book, and they made a good movie. And we're nitpicking. And had the director of the movie worried about the details that we're now discussing, I think you would end up with a movie that would become boring. Real life and real details. It's got so much complication to it. Mother Nature did not design this universe to be nice and friendly for us and to be easy to understand. Since you do so many books like this one, Paul, and you read this book some time ago, are there other books of this nature that you know of that are likely to also become a movie? I mean, since this movie is likely to get an Academy Award, somebody's going to jump on this bandwagon just like they did with Star Wars. So what's the next book coming down the pike that's going to turn into a movie that you know of, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
Yeah, unfortunately, there aren't enough books like this that, you know, when they come around, I will read them. And, I did read this quite a few years ago. Let's see, 2009 it came out. I probably read it in 2011, I think. And then after I read it, I told my daughter about it. She thought it was great. She couldn't put it down. And then I, you know, right after that, you know, I predicted, I said, this would make a good movie. And sure enough, after she finished it, it came out that they were going to make a movie in about a year. I was kind of shocked. So I guessed right there, but I've seen a couple other ones come and go. I just don't know why they haven't made one about the biosphere, too. That's my next prediction. And, you know, a couple of people I've talked to agree with that as well. But even so, it's not a space type of movie. I think it's a piece of history, and yeah, I don't want to see it as a documentary. I think it would make a good movie. Back in
I agree with you. Biosphere 2, where Biosphere 1 is the planet we live on, Biosphere 2 is this closed cycle thing that was used twice in Arizona. And Mrs. Poynting, I think her name is, did a good job on that one. And depending on how much nitpicking you do there, there are reporters who think that that turned into a failure. Another way of looking at it is the whole reason you run an experiment is because you're not positive what the result's going to be. It's a proof of concept is the reason why you run an experiment. And so they made a number of discoveries. Who the hell would have ever anticipated that the oxygen in your closed environment is going to be absorbed by the concrete, the freshly made concrete in that environment? Who would ever would have thought that? And it was quite a mystery there for, I'm guessing, a good number of months as to why was the oxygen disappearing. And it's very important for human beings. These guys, they want to live on 21% oxygen. I think we're down to 14%. And so that slows down an awful lot of your living procedures. Now, your daughter read the book The Martian, and she was quite enthralled with it. From what you know about your daughter, Paul, if she had the ability, would she volunteer for one of these Mars missions that are now being proposed? WS2N, K2IW?
No, that's not going to happen. No. I don't know anybody that would throw their hat in the ring outside of the astronauts that, you know, you'll see in an interview now and then. They might say something like that. No. It would have to be maybe 100 years down the road. This would have to be normal, commonplace type of thing. You know, you really have to be a pioneer. You have to be a certain type of person. Type of person that's going to jump off one of those mountains with wings on or something and fly through the mountains. Don't know anybody personally that would do that, Dick.
I'm predicting, Paul, that this movie is going to create greater number of people who will want to volunteer for Mars. Yes, the movie was talking about the very difficult situation that Matt Damon was in when he got abandoned on Mars. The other six astronauts took off without him, five astronauts. But there's many a person that's going to look at that movie and say, boy, that looks like a real exciting place to be. Of course, I'm not going to run into those problems that Matt Damon ran into. That looks like a nice frontier. I want to go there. To some degree, the movie with its good special effects, nice photography, to a certain kind of pioneering spirit person, is going to glamorize Mars. And as you guys know, I don't consider Mars very glamorous. That's an extremely severe environment by Earth standards. I'd still recommend you see the movie, though, John. Donna, do you think you're going to be able to squeeze this movie into your schedule? KC2WGB, K2RW?
Oh, absolutely. And by the way, where was this viewed? Was that a on television, or was that movie house stuff?
On Long Island, it's probably in 30 different movies simultaneously right now. And in some of those multiplex theaters, it's in more than one theater at a time, displaced in time. I didn't check, but I'll bet you there are some movie houses that are showing it in three dimensions. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, I went to a regular movie. But somebody did ask if they wanted us to go to 3D. So apparently it must be in 3D. But I can't say that for sure. Naturally, I went in Ronkonkoma. And we have motorized chairs. The whole chair goes back, you know. If it's a boring movie, you could pass out. I mean, it's really, really cool chairs out here. They just finished with that project last year. So, John, I would definitely go. You could always get the book. I actually don't have the book. It's on my tablet, so I do have the book, but I joined the modern world. I downloaded it back in there.
Yeah, there's an amazing number of people who don't get paper delivered to the house anymore. Their newspapers, their magazines, their books, everything is an electronic download into a tablet or under a computer screen. I'm old-fashioned. I still want to flip pages. There's a zillion theaters where you can see this one, John. Now, if you'd like, I'd like to give you a couple of words on what I think happened when you did your experiment, where you put a small loop of wire on the end of a piece of coax cable, and you slip that down into the slot, the 20-millimeter slot that's in your Hewlett-Packard 805 slotted line. I know you, I'm going to make a guess, you put 300 megacycles through it into either a good load or a known standing wave ratio load, and that loop of wire, at first you may have thought it was a directional coupler, soon about to find out it was not, but as you move that loop of wire in and out in depth, you saw the signal get stronger and weaker, and while you had a mismatched load, so you're really making a known standing wave ratio, as you move that loop of wire in the length direction, the Z direction, you saw the peaks and valleys of standing wave ratio as if you were using the normal detector. You saw that with that loop of wire, is my guess. Give us a few words on the experiment you did this week. I only heard a couple of words on this a couple of days ago, and it's a fun experiment you were doing, and I was going to give you some more of my impressions of it. KC2WGB, the slotted line expert, K2RIW and the TechNet. You got it, John.
KC2WGB. Yeah, expert getting in trouble with them. What I did was I made several diameter loops. Basically, they were short circuits. So it would be the same as having the short circuit put on the end of a piece of wood and putting it down in there. Okay, and then I noticed that as I traveled up and down the length of the line, one attitude, if the flat side of the loop was parallel with the traveling direction, there was very little effect on the line. When I rotated it, say 45 degrees, started sliding up and down. I noticed it had an effect. Then I also made L-shaped pieces of wire, and on the end of that little piece of wire, I had a resistor, a 50-ohm resistor, to terminate it to ground. And as I moved that up and down, I had no load on the line at all, so I had maximum SWR. The reflection was way up. And I was working at, that was 400 megahertz. And as I moved that little slot up and down, I could get in different positions. And when I raised and lowered it to change the coupling coefficient, I also could see signal strength changes. So to me, that was similar to what I see in directional couplers.
Okay, so one of the experiments, you had nothing on the output of the slotted line. There was an open circuit, which is a pure reflection, which means you had an infinite standing wave ratio. And when you made a loop on the end of your coax cable, and maybe it was a piece of semi-rigid coax, you had a loop of wire going into a 50-ohm resistor that went back to ground, meaning the shield of the coax cable. You called it ground. I'm pretty sure that's what you meant by ground, as opposed to anything of grounding of the slotted line itself. And so there is a magic depth of that particular loop plus 50-ohm resistor. There's a magic depth where maybe going to achieve relatively high directivity. It's going to take a little bit more work to do that. See, there's a, for each loop at each particular frequency, there's a magic resistor which will give you high directivity. And if you manage to get the directivity high, if you manage to make your directional coupler so it see the forward signal without seeing the reverse signal. Let me drop. And even though you've got an extremely high standing wave ratio on your slotted line, because you have a pure open circuit as a load, if you manage to make your directional coupler high enough in directivity, as you moved it in the Z direction, there would be no change in amplitude, because the forward signal is not going up and down. The reverse signal is not going up and down. It's only when you're using a non-directional probe, like the original spike of wire going into the crystal detector, that takes the forward signal and the reverse signal and mixes them together in the probe. And now the forward and reverse in some places are co-phase, other places they're antiphase. You hear peaks and valleys, and that's the standing wave issue. But with your nearly directional coupler, as you achieve high directivity and you move it along the z-axis, the length of the line, there would be no change. And to set that up as an experiment to some people would be a mind blower, but it really demonstrates the magic of a directional coupler. Wonder how close you came to that. There's ways I can get you closer to that one, Paul. John, KC2WGB, KQIW.
KC2WGB. Well, I'll give you a better description of what I did with the resistor. I took a piece of copper strip, spring copper, and I put that inside of the 21-millimeter most two through connection, the traveling section of the waveguide or the coupler. This then went to that piece of wire that was shaped like an L. As I dragged it along the line, and I had that hooked up to a demodulator probe to go into my oscilloscope, and I would pull that along the line and maintain contact to ground. It was a little staticky, but that's how I got the 50 ohm impedance to stay fairly constant, and some strange things were going on there. A lot of it must have been the fact that I couldn't hold it perfect at the coupling coefficient point where I was getting the best results. But that's basically how that went down.
Okay, I don't recommend you try to do any kind of grounding to the slotted line itself, because no matter how you make contact to it, it's going to be a scratchy contact. There's ways that you can set up your directional coupler probe where you use nothing but the semiconductor and shield of the cable of your probe. And now, in order to be able to slide it in the Z direction, the length of the line, without changing orientation or penetration, there's ways that you could clamp that directional coupler group of yours to the original carriage that holds its wire probe. The wire probe on that carriage, I believe, is to some degree retractable. And even if it's down there, it's not creating a great deal of interference. But if you could retract it, but by various mechanical configurations...
Yes, Dick, it is retractable.
Okay, and you don't have to pull it all the way out, but if you tracked it to a point where it is having very little coupling, and now if your coaxial cable with your loop and resistor is a thoroughly independent device, not making any physical contact to the two slabs of the 20 millimeter gap in your slotted line, but now that is connected to your carriage with some kind of an adjustable mechanism that adjusts the depth of your probe, and once it's connected to the carriage, now you can slide the carriage back and forth, and everything on your coupler stays constant. Once you design the coupler correctly, so that it has high directivity, which is going to be taking that 50 ohm resistor. There's nothing magic about 50 ohms. There is some magic number of ohms. It's going to make your coupler have high directivity. Maybe it's 37 ohms, maybe it's 69 ohms. There's some magic number of ohms that's going to give it high directivity. Once you achieve that high directivity, and it's now being held constant in depth and crosswise dimension by way of being attached to the carriage, and now you slide the carriage, you're going to see that magic effect that I've been predicting for some time, that now your directional coupler will not display standing wave ratio, even though the original probe on the carriage does. And that comparison is really going to demonstrate an interesting principle of what's going on here. Over to you, John, KQRIW.
Now, that's what I'm trying to set up so I would be able to talk to you about this situation. Now, what I've discovered, I had a cylinder of Teflon, approximately about a centimeter, maybe a little bit less. I cut it in half longitudinally, and it's about 2 inches long. I placed that on top of that center line, spotted line, and I put my, I melted that piece of L wire that I had in there. It's like, I think it was 18 gauge. So I have a piece of wire sticking up, and now I can slide that the full length of the line without changing the coefficient of coupling. So that gets me past that part. The only thing is, I haven't determined what distance I should make between the slotted line element and that piece of wire. I could build up on that piece of Teflon, which will maintain the space the whole length of the line, but that's what I'm basically working on now.
Yeah, I can see how you took the Teflon tubing and cut it, and that became a kind of a shield to give you a fixed distance between your probe and the real center conductor of the slotted line. That's one approach. Unfortunately, that piece of Teflon is starting to change the Z0 of your line. It's starting to make it a 45 ohm instead of a 50 ohm slotted line. By way of finding a way, it's gonna take a lot of mechanical doodads, but there's got to be a way where if your probe was made out of semi-rigid coax cable as opposed to a flexible braided cable, and you now find ways of attaching it to the carriage so that now as you move the carriage, its dimensions to the center conductor of the slotted line stays the same, both in the Z direction and the X direction. Z, X, and Y, everything stays the same as you slide it across the length of the slotted line. That's going to demonstrate the principle. And now if you can find the magic resistor that gives the thing high directivity, you're going to be home free. What are you using as the detector? Is the signal generator being modulated at a 1 KC rate and you're going into an ordinary Hewlett-Packard standing wave ratio indicator? Over to you, Paul, KQRIW.
KC2WGB. Basically, I'm using my oscilloscope, and I have a probe that rectifies it, and I can watch the DC drift with the amplitude of the wave as I go up and down. I can do the same thing with the carriage, of course, as I slide the carriage. If I hook my scope up to it and set it up for a DC analysis, low impedance, high attenuation or low attenuation, whatever I need to get a signal, When I slide it up and down, I can see the valleys and the peaks, and it works out perfectly without any modulation at all.
Yeah, but you're looking at a DC voltage on an oscilloscope. It'll become a little bit more clear as to what's going on. If your signal generator was being modulated with a 1 kilohertz square wave, now the oscilloscope, looking at the rectified RF, would be looking at square waves, which really demonstrates the amplitude of the RF that's there. And you can change the sweep rate on the oscilloscope so that the square waves are either synchronized and easily displayed, or just a blur, so that it just becomes a shaded coloring of the oscilloscope screen. What is the detector? First of all, is your probe on a piece of semi-rigid cable? And what are you using as a detector, John? Over to you, K2LIW.
WGB. I'm using a simple oscilloscope detector probe, basic rectifying probe. I'm using that, flexible, rigid or semi-rigid. It's a regular probe. I'm trying to get the basics of the structure first before I go into making anything more sophisticated than that. I figured if I can detect the RF envelope alone, that's getting me close. I can sure I can get the coefficient of coupling exactly where I need it for maximum transfer, and you know, try to work with one frequency as I can, and then I will refine it more and more as I go. Now, I know you're right about the, it may take, it could be a 40 ohm resistor, might even be a 25 ohm resistor, I'm finished, but right now I'm using a basic little 50 ohm resistor, and you think I should proceed without any resistor at all?
Oh no, that's not what I said. You're going to be using a resistor. First of all, John, you're one of the very few people on the East Coast of the United States as a ham radio operator who has taken apart a Nodder directional coupler because you were fixing it. Inside of the directional coupler, you saw the straight-through tri-plate strip line. You saw the straight-through so-called center conductor, which is really a slight web, if you know what I mean. You saw the coupled line, or maybe it was round, doesn't matter. You saw the coupled line, and the magic of the coupled line on, say, a 10 or a 20 dB directional coupler is that it had a certain spacing, a constant spacing between the coupled line and the straight through line, and one end of that straight through line came into an output sampling connector. The other end of that sampling line, of that coupled line, had a built-in perfect 50 ohm resistor built into the coupler. Because that strip line Nodder, let me drop. Because that Nodder directional coupler was carefully designed so that in the coupling region, where the center conductor snakes down a little bit, and the center conductor also snakes down a little bit, where it's parallel, it has the right Z odd, Z even, so that everywhere in there, both the straight through line and the coupled line, is exactly 50 ohms. Therefore, 50 ohms was the right way of terminating. There's nothing magic about 50 ohms on the coupled line. You can design the coupled line any diameter, any spacing you like to give you the right coupling coefficient. And as long as you choose the right value of the resistor for your particular coupling line, you can achieve high directivity. That's what I think you're trying to do. Now, you're saying you're using a oscilloscope detecting probe. I've seen lots of oscilloscope probes, like a clamp-on probe for measuring current, and a times 10 and times 1 probes, a detecting probe. Way back in the days of a vacuum tube voltmeter, there was this great big bulby thing that you put on the end of a line coming out of your vacuum tube voltmeter, which was an RF detector. That's not what I think you're talking about. I've never seen a compact detecting probe for an oscilloscope. Describe that one to me. Is that a Tektronix product? Over to you, John, K2LIW.
So the one I'm using is one I built myself. It's just a 1N34, might be 1N64 in there. A few years ago I built that. Very simple probe, and it does a pretty good job. I do have Tektronix rectifying probes, but they're so huge, to put them in there just makes it very difficult. This is a beautiful little thing. It's like maybe not even a half of a centimeter square, and it works.
Okay, you might get a prettier display on the oscilloscope screen if the signal generator was 1 KC on-off modulated, and now it's going to color a certain region of the scope screen as opposed to just displaying a straight horizontal line which goes up and down. To see that colored region makes the point a little bit more clear to a uninformed person seeing your equipment for the first time. Assuming your oscilloscope's got enough brightness that you can make that colored region, in other words, it's going to be from the baseline up to your voltage, it's going to be filled in with some vertical lines. I say that a square wave spends very little time in the transition. Yeah, that section's not going to be very bright. I'm not sure you're going to want to do that. Now, you've got a 1 in 34 RF detecting probe. I wonder if you should put that into a piece of semi-rigid. Okay. You want to do the experiment at 400 megs. Do you have any kind of an oscilloscope-like thing that will look at the 400 megacycle directly without rectifying it? Do you have any kind of an oscilloscope-like thing or any other kind of a measurer thing? A spectrum analyzer would do it. A spectrum analyzer in the zero sweep mode will easily detect 400 megacycles. And it's going to give you, depending on how you set the controls, it can give you a linear display in voltage or a decibel display in the 10 dB per box, so to speak. I'm beginning to think you're going to get the prettiest display with your directional coupler being a loop into a X number of ohm resistor back to the shield of the semi-rigid cable. That semi-rigid cable is going to be in some manner clamped to your carriage of your slotted line. The output of that semi-rigid cable will become a flexible cable that goes over to a spectrum analyzer. The spectrum analyzer is set in the whatever sweep mode you like. It could be zero sweep or setting 10 megs per centimeter horizontal. It doesn't matter. But the spectrum analyzer will display the signal directly. It's got huge sensitivity compared to a crystal detector. And it doesn't have the problem of a crystal detector. The first couple of tenths of a volt on a crystal detector doesn't do anything. In other words, it's got this huge nonlinearity down near zero. A spectrum analyzer has none of that. And it can look at the RF directly. You see where I'm going with this one, boy? John. Over to you, John. KQRIW.
KC2WQB. Dick, you just gave me a great idea. I have two oscilloscopes like the LaCroix, which they go to 1 gig. So now I can look directly at it and put that modulating frequency on and go to infinite phosphor persistence. It will actually paint the picture on there. As the DC level changes, it would be full for the entire width of the screen.
Hold on now. You don't have to. If you had modulated the signal generator with a square wave, the square wave spends 50% of its time high, 50% of its time low. It's really 49.9 of each, and very little time in the transition, so the vertical is not going to create very much brightness. If you display the 400 megacycle sine wave directly on your LaCroix, assuming your LaCroix will display 400 megs, and you display the sine wave directly, that's even better than having the signal generator 1 KC modulated. The signal generator is now a pure CW output being picked up with a piece of semi-rigid coax cable, which after the carriage converts to a flexible piece of cable, which goes over to the LaCroix. Now the LaCroix displays the voltage directly as a 400 megacycle sine wave. That will brighten a certain region of the screen, if you know what I mean. Vertical display with some brightness to it. It'll paint a portion of the screen. You see where I'm going on this one, Paul? John. How are you, John? K2RIW.
Very good, Dick. Yes, I can display that. It goes to 1 gig with no problem. 1.3, I think, is the rate. So I could do that. And as I look at tenuous persistence, screen varying with the amount of amplitude. Okay, I can try that. Also, I noticed that when I look at the output of carriage on the LaCroix, I think the square law of the diode that's in that carriage is causing a bottom envelope problem in the sine wave. The top looks very good, but when it gets to the bottom, it's compressed slightly, and I thought maybe there was something wrong with the oscilloscope. I tried it without the rectifier, and it works fine. So that rectifier is causing some kind of a problem at the negative portion of the sine wave.
Oh, exactly right. In the case of a 1N34, until you hit 0.2 volts, it doesn't do anything. In the case of a Schottky or in the case of a silicon diode, until you hit 0.7 volts, it doesn't do anything. So all diodes near 0 volts have got a crazy kind of nonlinearity, square lower region, so to speak. Whereas if you can display the RF directly with no rectification, got it made. Now, the only thing I'm worried about is an oscilloscope that can go to 1.2 gigahertz really has a noise equivalent bandwidth of 1.2 gigahertz. It's a very broadband thing. Therefore, I'm a little bit worried about what is its maximum sensitivity. It's going to have a high noise figure, if you know what I mean, because of its huge bandwidth. And there's no easy way of limiting that. You can't put any video integration onto that. What do you believe is the best sensitivity of the LaCroix? I'm a little bit worried that that probe might not pick up enough voltage unless you put a watt of signal down the line of the slotted line. So what's your best guess as to the best sensitivity of the LaCroix when it's in the mode that can display 400 megacycles as a direct sine wave? Over to you, John, KQLAW.
D2WGB. There, I have no idea. I would have to check and see. But I cannot operate that at a low attenuation. I have to attenuate it maybe in the third portion of the attenuator, because if I lower the probe on the carriage, I get so much coupling that it'll pin the scope out. So that coupling works really well, and that's with a 0 dBm going in from the generator.
The magic of the original probe of the Hewlett-Packard 805 slotted line is the probe goes down there and samples, let me pick a number, 1% of the RF energy flowing down the line. It's an extremely small perturbation to the line. You're running into a Heisenberg uncertainty principle here. In other words, your instrumentation that makes the measurement tends to disturb the measurement you're making. But in the case of that probe where you can change the depth of the normal slotted line, a simple piece of wire going down there, you can make the piece of wire just barely sample 1% or 0.1% of the signal, so it doesn't disturb it. So therefore, your techniques of putting the loop laying on top of a piece of Teflon is making a huge perturbation to the line. It's creating the visual that you think is being created by the load on the slotted line. Your probe, if it's resting on that Teflon, is creating a visual. The probe is creating a visual. It's going to create confusing readings. Whereas if you got the ability to put your loop about as close to the line as the normal probe that's on the carriage, or a little bit further away, and if your oscilloscope or whatever, spectrum analyzer, has enough RF sensitivity that with that very light loading, you can make the measurement, now you'd be doing very little disturbing of that semiconductor of the slotted line. You see what I'm worried about on that one, John? KC2WGB, KQLAW.
Wow, you just gave me another good idea, Dick. I can cut a channel in a Teflon block that will slide on the top where the carriage is. I can cut it at, it's 21 millimeter. I'll cut it at 20 millimeters. This way it'll have only half a millimeter on each side to play with. And I can put my loop, I can glue the loop to the Teflon block. This way it will maintain the altitude correctly over the slotted line portion I'm looking to measure.
So you're going to make a new Teflon carriage. It doesn't have to be Teflon. It could be wood or plastic or plexiglass. That's your choice. By the way, when I first asked you the dimensions of your slotted line, you told me the gap is 20 millimeters. Maybe you said 21 and I heard 20. You told me 20 millimeters was the gap, John. Go ahead.
Okay, I don't have the paperwork in front of me, but you might be right. I also did a thorough examination the other night after speaking with you. I put some floodlights in there and took some measurements with filler gauges. There is no taper to that exit hole, or the tunnel, as we were calling it, and the tunnel is has a radius of about 20 millimeters, and I believe the span between the chamber walls was 21. Well, anyway, there's a half a millimeter short on the radius, so there is a little revealing edge on there. Not much, but it's there some.
Very interesting. So, after all of these years of me saying that if you took the probe by some magic that's in a Bird Model 43 watt meter in the slug and could get that into your directional, into your slotted line, and you moved it along the slotted line, you would see no radiation, even though you had a huge standing wave ratio on the slotted line. I was saying that as a theoretical discussion for years. All of a sudden, you're about to really carry it out. Interesting. By the way, is your loop on the end of a piece of semi-rigid, or right now is your loop on the end of a piece of a flexible coax cable? Over you, John.
Yeah, it was just on a piece of flexible coaxial cable. Plus, I had it where it was just handheld, without any cables attached to it, rotating the loop, trying to make it parallel with the line, and then it quadrature to the line, and moving it up and down the length of the line at the same time, to find out when that thing started to conduct, was it drawing energy away from the carriage detector? And it does. And you can see that on the scope immediately in certain areas. Just playing with this thing has just been very, very... And that's what made me think about a slotted line could be made into a directional coupler. So that's how I got involved, started with this thing. But it's been fun.
Absolutely, a slotted line can be made into a directional coupler. But the good news is it proves a principle of standing wave ratio. It proves the fact that there's always a signal of constant amplitude going forward, always a signal of constant amplitude, usually lower, going back. However, when you succeed in making your probe a perfect directional coupler, now have a way of sampling the power that's on the slotted line, you can no longer make a standing wave ratio measurement unless you have the ability of rotating the probe 180 degrees. You may have to take it out of the slotted line, rotate your whole carriage holding mechanism, and plug it back in. So you're going to have to now rotate the probe to look at the difference between forward and reverse. The original probe on the carriage, it's the magic of that probe is, first of all, you can make very light coupling so it doesn't disturb the center conductor signal on the slotted line. And second of all, it is the first thing that mixes together forward flowing signal and reverse flowing signal. Therefore, as you slide that carriage, you see the place where the two signals are co-phase, where they're aiding, and another place where they're canceling each other. And therefore, you see the peak in the valley that we call slotted line. With your directional coupler, you're going to lose that ability unless you have the ability of making 180 degrees reversal of your slotted line, of your directional coupler. So it proves a point, but it makes a piece of test equipment that's not as convenient to use anymore. How about you, John? KGRIW.
KC2WGB. Well, that gives me another idea. I have so many bird slugs. I could machine a bird slug, take that cap off, it will fit in that opening, and I could put that on a type of sliding carriage and just connect the wires to those two contacts that are on either side of the slug and bring that up to a piece of equipment. I could rotate it. Should be no problem.
I don't recommend that one, John. The slug itself is a hell of a lot larger in diameter than 20 millimeters, so it's not going to fit in there. Yes, you can re-machine it, so you can force it to fit in there, but no, I don't recommend that. On top of that, the slug is made for a very specific frequency region. There's more in that slug than meets the eye. It is a directional coupler. It's got a loop of wire It's got a resistor. And then that in turn goes into a low-pass filter. A directional coupled line that is less than a quarter wavelength long falls off at 60 dB per octave as you go down in frequency. And they put in a low-pass filter to correct for that. Okay, you're making progress. We're down to 1 minute before the machine is going to cut us off. This was TechNet number 1578 of the series that began in September of 1982. We'll be back next week, and more directional coupler slotted line. Who in the world would ever put a directional coupler in the slotted line? What a crazy thing to do. KC2WGB, K2IW. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB, that's what happens when you get old. You have nothing better to do, Dick. I'd like to thank everybody for joining us and signing in on Echo Link and the chat room and delivering some of these nice questions for us. So look forward to next week. And everybody have fun. And remember, it's a hobby. Enjoy it. Back to you, Dick. And good night, Paul.
Good night, Mrs. WS2N, wherever you are.
Told him he could leave so early.
He's out reading more of those science fiction books. He's trying to predict what the next movie's going to be, John.
I wish I had time for movies.
Yeah, this movie is worth seeing. Very well done special effects. And Matt Damon, as usual. There are people who think this is his best movie. Well, the Bourne sequence of Matt Damon was extremely well done. And Goodwill Hunting with Matt Damon was also very well done from my point of view. Of you, John.
Yeah, I like that. Good Will Hunting was a good movie and very interesting. By the way, this movie you're speaking about, you say the cinematography was good and the continuity was good. The editing.
Oh, you're going to like all of the above. I guarantee they spent 50 megabucks on making crops. Don't see very much of what you would call computer-generated animation. An awful lot of it looks to me like they really made those props. And so, now it's very well done. They made a very serious effort on this thing. And so, on Long Island, it's in a zillion theaters, so most likely in the five boroughs, it's also in a zillion theaters of home. And I think you have the choice of seeing it in 3D or regular. I saw it in regular. It's good enough. It didn't have to be 3D. Over to you, Paul. You're going to like it.
Yeah, I don't even know if we have any 3D theaters here, but I don't need 3D. I don't need high definition. You know, I'm just... Because I watch, like, Turner Classic movies. So I'm not used to that stuff. Well, enjoy, Dick, and I'll talk to you about this as I progress down the line here, and we'll have another discussion. But be well.
Yeah, directional couplers are so poorly covered in all of the amateur literature, in all of the literature that amateurs get a hold of. It's poorly covered even in professional literature. It's such an extremely high performance, very useful, very inexpensive, thoroughly passive device that can make such great RF measurements, and there are very few books telling you what it is, and no courses tell you what it is. So what you're doing right now is going to be shining a nice bright light on directional couplers. Good stuff. Bye-bye, John.
Good night, Dick. And thank you, everyone on the net. Next week, KC2WGB clear. KD2CBB, 2WGB. 2WGB clear.
Radio Yankee listening.
N2XJN, KC2WGB.
Amateur radio repeater system.
Don't think of any of that because none of it makes any sense or works in that sense. Oh, by the way, when you told me it's time to switch, I was in that little dead zone switching from the four-laner to the three-laner.
Figured, once you told me you were just on the turnpike and whatnot, with the time elapsed since we started talking, yes, that's exactly where I figured you were. And CB and Mobile, by the way, just getting onto the Wancha. I mean, getting off the Wancha onto the Northern.
Now that I'm up to Willis, I should be clean again. Now, there's a couple little dead spots in the antenna.
Stay here.
I'm not going anywhere.
Good morning, guys. WB2, EAV Mobile.
What's up, Ed? I see you joined us as you said you would.
Right, Edward.
How are you?
I am doing excellent. I didn't hear the call. Is that Gary?
Yes, it is. How have you been? Haven't spoken to you in a while.
Well, I am starting my new job today, and I am thrilled about it.
Finally going to be the guy who sits on the assembly line with the little hammer, hitting the nose cones of the bombs to see which ones are duds.
How did you know? That's secret.
Good buddy Bugs Bunny had that job.
Yeah, now that you mention it, I remember that. Now, Gary, I don't know if I told you why I'm so thrilled.
I'll bet it's because you can get up this early in the morning to go to work.
Bet it's because it's an all-cash job and he doesn't have to give up his Social Security because he's not going to declare this as income.
I'm supposed to say that on an open frequency.
Say that out loud? Oh, no.
Now you're all wrong. A, I was, excess by Northrop Grumman a year ago, almost to the day. It's nice to be getting back to work. And B, I spent several of the past few months in this year being in no condition to work, going to see doctors all the time. So I'm thrilled for both reasons.
Well, hopefully a lot of those bombs are duds so you don't blow up quickly.
There's a consummation devoutly to be wished.
At least if one of them's not a dud, the end will be over quick and painlessly.
Bugs Bunny had that job, you would think that'd be a job for Wile E. Coyote.
Remember they gave him that job after Martin the Martian was playing around with the B-52 bomber? It wasn't Martin the Martian, it was the, I want to say Gremlin, but it's eluding me to the name. The little guy that was supposed to, like, screw up the airplane, that, and him and Bugs Bunny and everything, and the B-52 is crashing to the ground, and then he finally pulls the air brakes switch.
Are you sure it was a B-52? I think they made most of those cartoons before the B-52 came out. Which is funny, because the B-52 is now like 60 years old.
Well, it was a darn big bomber. So, whatever the biggest darn flying, propeller-driven bombing machine was for World War II, that must have been what it was. Maybe it was